Welcome back to Game of Thrones 2 Electric Boogaloo. I'm your host, Anthony. This week we return north to the Wall with Professor Ian McGinnis. Ian is professor at the Highlands and Islands in Scotland. Steve and I talk about the penultimate episode to season 5. This is the episode where Shireen gets burned at the stake. And then in my bird's eye view, I include a short excerpt of my longer conversation with Chris Swank. She will be returning at a later episode to talk more about Catelyn Stark. A brief word about Steve and I. We are actually starting two new podcasts. One is called Perfect Stranger Things, where we cover the first season of Netflix's Stranger Things. The first episode of Perfect Stranger Things is due out Monday. The other is called Cocoons of Horror, and that one we cover the schlocky movies that inspired Stranger Things. So those are two totally different podcasts. They do overlap, but one is called Perfect Stranger Things, the other one is called Cocoons of Horror, and that should be available now if you search for Cocoons of Horror. So search for those wherever you search for podcasts. Without further ado, here is Dr. Ian McGinnis. I hope that I'm not taking you away from Chloe or...
She's outside and I'm happy there for the moment.
Okay, so. Good. I'm assuming it's not a wet and dreary day where you are?
It's cold and gray, but it seems to be dry for the moment. We're supposed to be getting gales tomorrow, apparently.
Now, if you're like me, Ian, you know that the brochures for your institute are usually shot. You know, they have the photo shoots on like the sunniest day of the year. Right?
Yes. We have some various bits of marketing material which shows the Highlands at its best. Yeah.
Right. They're usually going to give you a sunny day.
Yeah.
And then, you know, when you get there, you learn that there's maybe like one day a year where it looks like that. And I was thinking the Wall probably has this issue too. It's supposed to be like a sunny and warm day at the Wall in this chapter. I was thinking they're probably doing all their promotional material on this one sunny and warm day at the Wall.
How to sell the Night's Watch to the recruits.
That's right. I have questions about the Night's Watch. I want to get your opinion on. But I'm going to read this. I'm going to read my synopsis first. All right. So Sam sits down next to Jon with the good news. He has been passed through and will be assigned to Maester Aemon. Both Sam and Jon are happy of the news, but Jon keeps to himself the part that he played in this development. The boys gather inside the Sept. They each learn which part they will play. Some, including Gren and Pip, will be off to the Rangers. Sam will be a steward. Then Jon learns to his dismay that he has been assigned to the stewards as well. Jon is shocked, angry, and bitter. Then Sam points out that the old bear might be grooming him for command. Later, Jon and Sam are escorted north of the Wall to take their vows in a circle of 9 weirwoods. Ghost runs into the wood and returns with a human hand. So, Dr. Ian McGinnis, do you want to talk about a character, a plot point, a theme, or shall you and I climb the ladder of chaos?
I might try the ladder of chaos this time.
Oh, well, it's perilous. I don't know. This is all right. Well, let's let you go first then. You take the first rung.
Okay. I thought one of the interesting themes was the Night's Watch itself. The vow they took. I think there's all manner of interesting kind of parallels there, but also Martin going out on a limb perhaps a little bit. But I thought that, you know, there's obvious links between the Night's Watch and the medieval military orders. But I also thought with the vow as well, there's also a kind of comparison with men being inducted into medieval knighthood as well.
Which, right. I would like to hear you talk about that. Let me go ahead and read the vow. I'm sure that lots of folks have heard it before, but just so we know what we're talking about. Hear my words and bear witness to my vow. Night gathers. And now my watch begins. It shall not end until my death. I shall take no wife, hold no lands, father no children. I shall wear no crowns and win no glory. I shall live and die at my post. I am the sword in the darkness. I am the watcher on the walls. I am the fire that burns against the cold, the light that brings the dawn. the horn that wakes the sleepers, and the shield that guards the realms of men. I pledge my life and honor to the Night's Watch for this night and all the nights to come. So what did you see in this vow that interested you?
I mean, I think that the whole idea of joining a kind of fraternal order, military order or militaristic order, I think has obvious parallels to the military orders that grew up in the Middle Ages, post First Crusade, the Templars and the Hospitallers and the Teutonic Knights. And I think that there are obvious parallels there, although of course the Night Watch is like the kind of bastard brother of it, in as much as it takes all the waifs and the strays.
It's not
something that most people join voluntarily, although some do. But I think the vow itself as well, you know, those statements of you know, that you're essentially rejecting your past life, you're giving up any notion of landholding or marriage and children, and all these things are very important in the Middle Ages. You know, again, the parallels to the military orders, I think, are quite clear. But at the same time, I think also the comments of things in terms of what they're there to do, they're there to protect people, they're there to serve. I mean, there is also, unsurprisingly, I suppose, but a parallel with someone being inducted into knighthood as well, which is has religious connotations, but is still more secular. And I did think that the vow, and indeed the Night's Watch itself, is quite a secular enterprise.
I think I have a different view on this. In one sense, you can kind of see like the septon and the sept are, you know, almost an afterthought at the wall.
At least it
seems that way. Even the septon is, you know, drunk most of the time or whatever. Although I will say this, you know, this is not the first drunken septon we've heard of.
It's almost like the last.
Yeah, it's like every other septon that's mentioned in World of Ice and Fire is a drunkard. And even like Thoros of Myr, he's not a septon. You know, he's a priest or whatever. He's also a drunk. So I think George must have known a few priests in his life who hit the sauce once too often, I suppose.
Modern pop culture, though, I think quite often has that kind of attitude towards the church. It's almost always depicted as being degenerate, and its representatives are, you know, two-faced and preaching one thing while behaving another. I think it's quite a common modern perception of the medieval, or the quasi-medieval church.
Sure, yeah, right. So anyway, I think I would argue that the Night's Watch is actually a very highly religious institution. And I'm thinking about this in sort of sociological terms. Not necessarily that it's connected very well to the you know, the faith of the seven or the old gods or whatever, but one definition of religion, and this would be sort of Durkheim, is to say that this is a community that is in the orbit of something that they perceive as supernatural, and in this case, I think that the gravitational force is the wall itself. We know that the wall is supernatural, but we don't know it very clearly. But even from the Night's Watch perspective, they view themselves as holding back the darkness. You know, it's almost very much this sort of dualistic light and dark idea. And of course, the wall is everything. It looms over everything in the Night's Watch. It really is the supernatural gravitational force that defines the existence of this monastic order at the wall. And of course, as you pointed out, you know, the take no wives, father no children, you know, forsake all of your land holdings, all of that business. That all sounds very monastic as well. What do you think about that?
I see where you're coming from. Absolutely. I suppose I hadn't considered that element of the supernatural and that kind of the wall and the duty as perhaps an article of religious faith as opposed to something else. I suppose I just saw it as you know, that what they're doing is absolutely, they're signing up to something that has a quasi-monastic feel to it.
Yeah,
they are to perform a duty, whether they choose to be there or not. Once they're there, that's what they sign up to. That's what the vow is about. It's about signing up to things. It's almost like conscription, but then, you know, buying into that that brotherhood and what it stands for and what they're there to do. But it is about defense, it is about protection. There is discussion to an extent of honor. And I just saw all that as being intensely secular, in as much as, it is a warrior code, it's a warrior society. And while, as you said, there is that religious underpinning, there's the sept in there, there is the religious element in which, you say your vow in a religious context or before a religious individual or representative. But beyond that, everything else I saw as being far more secular in nature, but I might be wrong.
No, I think that that probably would be a natural reading of it. I feel like my reading is probably the outlier here. I mean, the way that I'm looking at this is that the true religion at the wall, if that's the right term, the true religion at the wall is the maintenance of the wall, because the wall almost functions as this titan, magical titan kind of figure. Even the mythology behind it. Anyway, then I just, and the reason why the septon seems like an afterthought and the sept seems like an afterthought is because it's always sort of going to be second banana to the true deity, and that being the wall itself. I did want to talk about a little bit about the choice to take the vow. All right, is there a flaw in this? Tell me if there's a flaw here. All right. Let's say you're like, let's see, who's the guy that's accused of rape here? A Darian. All right. Let's say you're like Darian. All right. So you're accused of rape and sent to the wall. You go through your little acolyte process, and then Mormont stands up and says, "All right, anyone who wants to leave, go ahead. There's the door." What happens if Darian just walks out the door? What happens then? I mean, I guess the question is, does someone like Darian really have a choice?
Well, yeah, I don't suppose he feels he's got anything to go back to, but yeah, as you said, considering the gap or the geographical distance between where he's come from and where he's ended up, surely there is an alternative. I mean, I suppose it just comes back to kind of peer pressure, doesn't it? I mean, the way it's depicted in the book, in the way it's filmed in the TV show as well. They're all standing there, they're all watching each other, but they're probably all potentially judging each other as well. And the leader is kind of looking down on them from on high. And yeah, I would have thought that few, well, I would imagine that few would take that opportunity to leave, even given the opportunity.
Yeah, honestly, it just felt like, all right, I'm done. I'm out of here. I'm going to Eastwatch and I'm sailing to Dorne. I don't know what I don't. It could be that, all right, sure, Darian, you can choose to leave, but as soon as you leave the premises,
Yeah, is somebody sending a crow down south to say he's left, come and arrest him or whatever?
And then someone like Ned Stark, picks you up on the way down and puts you back into prison. I don't know what happens, but there seems to be a little chink in the armor here.
Just on that point though, the first scene or the Ned's first scene when he's executing the deserter. Yeah, how does he know he's a deserter and he hasn't just chosen not to join up? Nobody comes back from the
Yeah, I guess they say that they questioned him for a while. Like they've got him
wall.
up on some wall questioning him. But he's like, a raving lunatic at that point. So what do they actually know? Who knows? I do think that there's a little flaw in the system here, but maybe no one's figured out how to exploit it
It's one of the things you're not supposed to ask too many questions
yet. So I want to talk a little bit about John, if that's all right. So as this begins, John really has had a little success. I mean, he's seen Sam's value. He kind of sees the designs of Sir Alistair. He's worried about Sam's safety. And so he makes an appeal to Maester Aemon, and it seems to have paid off. Maester Aemon's going to take Sam under his wing, and then Sam can kind of be released from the clutches of Alistair Thorne. And it's a sunny day at the wall, and the wall is glistening as it bleeds a little bit, and everything is bright, and things are going well, in other words, for John. And even so much so that, when Sam walks into the Sept, Pip and Gren are like shocked and kind of thrilled that Sam is actually there because they were a little bit dismayed about that business. And then John learns that he's going to be a steward. And I think he just feels like this is absolutely below his station. But everything we know about John up until this point is that he has no station.
Yeah.
In fact, he hates being called Lord Snow, I think, because that's an assumption about my class, you know, my upper class upbringing. You don't get it. I have no station. I'm a bastard. And yet he does feel a little bit entitled here.
Yeah, I think it's a recognition of while he has always been kept in his place, while he's always been reminded of what he is, especially by Caitlin. I think at the same time, though, he has been moving in those circles. He has been out with his stepbrothers around their father, doing, you know, learning fighting in the castle and doing the things that you would expect a lord's son to do, just at a slight remove. Mm-hmm. So I think, you know, he makes that comment, you know, I'm a better swordsman, a better rider than any of you. And I think that those types of skills absolutely come from a lordly upbringing. Those are the types of skills that young men in noble families would have been taught how to do. And I think he has benefited from that, despite, you know, being illegitimate. Mm-hmm. So, yes, I think he absolutely sees himself as being above that. I thought of it in terms as well. It reminds you that in the books, at least, he is still young. And it's that kind of reaction of it's not fair, because it's not what
you expect. Yeah, I think he's something like 14 or whatever. But would that have been considered young? I guess the question is, like, if someone wanted to join Teutonic Knights or something, would 14 be far too young for something like that?
Yeah, the military orders tend not to let children in. They allow children to be stationed there, kind of thing, but they don't expect them to take their vows. And indeed, you know, the church is very much against that, as a, you know, of them letting children in anyway, because it's, you know, they can't make that decision for themselves at that age. And it's not like convents or monasteries where you can just ship off your kids and that you don't want or can't look after, and the church will look after them forever. It is a different thing. And even in a military context, you wouldn't expect boys to be at war until probably around 16, I would suggest. So I think John's still below the kind of normal age for those things.
In the notes that you sent me in preparation, you mentioned that there's something of a tripart structure to the medieval view of life. I was curious about that.
I suppose it comes back to that kind of the modern perception of medieval society, which surrounds the use of the term feudal, although, of course, that's been rather picked apart in recent times. In historiography, but the classic idea is medieval society was split into the three orders, which is those who fight, those who work, and those who pray. And I just thought there was, you know, perhaps an echo of that in the watch, although in a slightly different way. But, you know, you have the builders, you have the riders, the rangers, sorry,
yeah,
and you have the stewards. So you have those who fight, those who work, And then those who do skilled work, perhaps.
Right. Those who fight, those who work, and those who change the bed sheets or whatever.
Yes.
So, yeah, it's interesting that there is that tripart structure. It may be, again, Martin likes to do these little things in hybrids, right? So he's probably bringing in a little bit of that.
Yeah.
This relationship between John and Sam is very interesting to me. And I mean, John has done so much for Sam, even so much that, you know, that maybe Sam doesn't even know how much he's done for him. But Sam really wants to attach himself to John. And I think that that's probably what motivates his decision to take the new gods. But that, to me, I mean, I guess that's tantamount to conversion, I suppose. But I think it's conversion for the sake of the friendship.
Yes, I think so. Although I wondered also if there was a kind of element of he says himself he's casting off everything, and with justification, considering how crappily he's been treated by his father. But he's throwing off everything to do with his family, including the religion, and actually taking his vows in front of the old gods. I mean, maybe that's him adopting a new religious identity as well as a personal or a secular one. It's almost a kind of baptism anew. He's embracing a new religion to represent his new self.
Yeah, I think so. And I think in this way, there's an interesting parallel here with Arya in the later books. And I think that Sam may do this even more successfully because, Sam really feels like he can't go home, right? It's not like he's, deep down in his core, he's a Tarly from Horn Hill, and so he's never going to truly be able to be, cast off that identity. I think that he's whole hog part of this new order. Whereas I think Arya is, that's kind of what the expectation of the Faceless Men for Arya. They want her to cast off her identity, her ego, her sort of personal designs. And I think that she can kind of become a good faker, but I don't think that she ever does what Sam does.
No, I think Arya uses the Faceless Men as a means to an end. She's she has a goal in mind, whether she perhaps recognizes it all the time or not, but it is to go home, it is to seek that revenge. Her list of people to
Yeah,
take
that's
out
her
that she
prayer.
wants to.
That's her
But
nightly
yeah,
prayer, right? That's her true
I mean that,
religion.
that yeah, exactly, and that's what she's training for. Whereas, yeah, I think Sam realizes he's got nowhere to go. I mean, it's not as clear in the book, but in the TV series, it absolutely is. He tells that story of what his father said to him, that he's going to take him out hunting, and then his horse is going to fall, and whether he's injured or not, he's not coming back, which is appalling. But yeah, it's Sam is not the son he wanted, so he wants shot of him. And so yeah, Sam has absolutely nothing to return to. Why not fully embrace his new reality, even though he's not necessarily suited for
Just to give you an opportunity, I'm just curious, are you seeing any historical analogs in this chapter?
I thought the idea of family and succession and sons and fathers, I thought was quite interesting. I mean, that obviously that allusion to Sam and the fact that his father has rejected him. That he's not the masculine fighter that he wants his son to be, that he wants his heir to be. But Sam's description of how his father used to take him along to meetings and things, rather like we've discussed in regards to John moving in those circles, but very much with a purpose for Sam, and then once he gets rid of Sam with Dickon, but that idea that he learns what it is to be a lord, how to behave, how to speak to his men, how to adjudicate, it's all meant to be a learning experience, and that's how young lords, would have been introduced to these things. I mean, it interesting that I suppose in a Scottish or even like an Irish context, you also had the idea of fosterage, where sons would be sent to the families of maybe neighbouring families or allied families, taken out of their comfort zone and thus learning in a different environment, but learning the same types of things, the same skills, and the skill set that they would need when they become a lord themselves. And that's where we then perhaps see the link between Mormont and John. If Sam's right, if Mormont selects John as his steward so he can do exactly the same with him, so he can effectively groom him for command later, that is an interesting thing, especially for John, because he's illegitimate, Mormont potentially then taking the role of his new father, or his alternate father,
That's
and that's quite an interesting thing as well, I thought.
And Mormont even says, when he's giving his little speech in the Sept, he says, "You're the only sons we will ever have."
Yeah, I thought that was quite an interesting line, considering the fact he does have a son.
He absolutely has a son, which I suppose he's disavowed. I mean, I guess one way to view this is like, this is the propaganda that every Lord Commander says, "You're the only sons we'll ever have." I mean, surely a number of these people who have come to the wall do have sons that they left behind. But, that metaphorically, it's like, no, this is our family now. You don't have any connections anymore in the South. This is our family. you're the only sons I'll ever have. And of course, I suppose he's choosing John to be his, you know, eldest son and heir if Sam's perspective, you know, wins the day.
But at the same time, that also suggests a kind of, you know, medieval style primogeniture, you know, the son follows the father. But as we see down the line, that's not actually how it works. You know, they have a quasi-democratic process in terms of choosing who the new Lord Commander should be. So Mormont kind of singling John out is not necessarily all it's cracked up to be, unless he's going to dictate who follows him.
We know how these things work. We know how these things work. There's going to be a George W. Bush that comes along, you know. You know, there's going to be a reason why the next Kennedy gets the political office. Anyway, I thought that was interesting. And then, you know, Sam is to be maybe the next maester, even though, you know, he's sort of starting out at this lower stage, you know, learning from Aemon, but also taking care of Aemon. That's very much of a father-son thing. When the father is sort of late in life and really needs the son to do a lot of parental work. And what one thing that Mormont says is, he's precious to us. You take good care of him. And but, I also thought it was interesting that Chet gets displaced. They're going to send poor Chet to the kennels now.
You're useless. Well, is that line of, the Sam says, I can help him. I can read and write his letters, kind of thing. And John says, oh, yes, you'd be good at that. But it's that social upbringing. Uh-huh. Of course, someone like Sam, or indeed John, can read and write because they're from noble households, whereas I presume Chet is not. So you know, he's useless. He can go down and look after the dog.
Right. Well, I mean, look, imagining that this has parallels to this part of the world in the 1200s or something, being able to read is actually quite an amazing feat. You know, not many people can do it. I mean, you could probably read enough to write your name, to sign a contract, to make a list, you know, a shopping list or whatever. But to be able to do what Sam does is really valuable. And honestly, how has Maester Aemon been writing letters and whatnot?
That's a good point.
Without someone like Sam.
I always find Aemon a very interesting character. That reveal as to who he actually is, I think, is quite... It comes slightly out of left field, and you don't see it coming.
Yeah, Aemon was a secret targ before it was cool to be a secret targ.
But and then of course, linking him even closer to Jon, even though he didn't know it.
Okay, finally, I want to talk a little bit about going north of the Wall. I think this is the first time we've seen a character go north of the Wall since the prologue of the book. And, you know, they go to the haunted forest, and there is a sense of foreboding. You know, it's like they're all sort of congratulating Sam and John for becoming men of the Night's Watch. Until, you know, there's that old grizzled veteran who says, I mislike the smell of the air. It's getting dark. Let's go back. And then Ghost trots up with a human hand in his snout. So you do get the sense. I mean, there is a sense of that Martin is kind of reminding that there's something supernatural up here. That you should be reminded of, dear reader. You know, even though you haven't seen it since the prologue, there's some spooky stuff up here. I think that there's something interesting about the parallel between Ghost and the weirwood trees. Let me read this little passage. And suddenly Ghost was back, stalking softly between the weirwoods. White fur and red eyes, John realized, disquieted. Like the trees. And then we have this pregnant ellipsis. Like the trees. I mean, clearly there's a parallel. And Martin is wanting us to see this parallel. Like, Ghost represents something supernatural. In the same way that the trees represent something supernatural. And here they are in sort of a grove of weirwood trees. And John is kind of, I don't know why he's just noticing this for the first time, but he is just noticing this for the first time. And so, in a sense, you have this almost, Ghost serves almost like this beast from the other side who's come to warn the humans.
Yeah, I think you have the whole thing as well of, you know, I think beyond the wall seems to be somewhere that Ghost belongs, even though, of course, you know, they found him south of the wall. But he's in his element there in the forest and in the snow.
Yeah.
And ultimately, you know, there is that recurring theme throughout the series that actually it's where John belongs as well.
Right.
You know, Ghost and John are something different. The Ghost is the albino wolf, and John obviously is the odd one out in his own family.
Yeah, black sheep,
which isn't his family. You know, so yeah, and that idea of and ultimately, you know, not undermining the end, but you know, it's where he'll end up going back to. So I think there is that idea of John kind of being where he's meant to be. And I suppose the supernatural bit of it, because I think earlier in this book, the other recruits have been saying to John about, you know, they're talking about his dream and saying that he's a warg, which of course, you know, relates back to his brother. But but yeah, that suggestion almost that John has some of that ability as well. John is associated perhaps with the supernatural too.
I think so, and I think that when Martin is calling out the parallel between the wolf and the weirwood, well. What is the weirwood? The weirwood represents the spirituality of the first man. Mm. And of course, the direwolf represents the sigil of the Starks. So of course, there's a parallel there. But also, it really is reminding John of his roots at the very moment when he's supposed to be eschewing his roots, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So I thought that was interesting there.
I think it is. It comes back to that the John as well being the only one who says, you know, he still follows the old gods. And that's, you know, again, that's quite a stark thing, but you associate it with it being a northern thing, which then seems to reinforce the fact that of all the recruits, and indeed even of the men who are there aren't actually that many Northmen there, which seems quite slightly odd, because you would expect the men of the north to be there, you know, protecting the realm, protecting their area, guarding the wall. John has that connection again through the Starks to those of old and to the old religion. But he, the fact that he's the only one, again, it kind of singles him out as being a bit different. But again, I think reinforces the fact that he's meant to be there.
Right. And I think that, I mean, maybe it goes to the sort of the disrepair of the Night's Watch. It could be that in the days of glorious past, you know, every second son of the Starks was going to go up to the wall, but
yeah,
it just so happens that most of the wall is mostly populated by people who were sitting in the prison at King's Landing. and so you got a lot of Southerners there.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah. So I suppose I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
No, I was just gonna say, I mean, obviously Bendon's there, but we see so little of him that you kind of forget about.
Yeah. I do get the sense that Mormont is sort of of course Bear Island is northern, but you know, he makes that comment like, of course there's a grove north of the wall because that grove was there thousands of years before, you know, the Andals brought their fancy new religion to Westeros.
Yeah.
He really is talking about, you know, talking like a northerner in this this chapter. All right,
the fact he's played by a Scotsman probably helps, but sorry.
Yeah. Yeah. All right, notable introductions. We meet Septon Celador, or Kelidar, I suppose I should say. Septon Kelidar, who's usually drunk.
Yes.
Othel Yarwick. I have this sort of headcanon for Septon Kelidar. He's probably from Highgarden or something. He's been assigned to the wall, and no one cares that he's there. he's got nothing better to do than get drunk.
It does beg the question, though, as to why he's been sent there. But
we meet Othel Yarwick, who's the first builder, and no notable departures in this chapter. However, we are reminded again that Benjen is not there. Show differences. This whole business with Mormont's speech takes place in the yard.
Yeah.
And I think it could be just be like, look, we don't need to build a new sept or a new set. We don't need to build a new set for this scene. Mm. let's just have Mormont give his little speech in the yard. But it does remind us that systematically the HBO show has removed a lot of the religious elements from the show.
Yeah.
So I'm thinking specifically the trial by combat between Bronn and Vardis Egan.
Mm.
You know, in the books, they kneel before a septon and, you know, there's this little religious ceremony that happens.
Yeah.
Not in the show. And then, of course, we have this scene that's not in the sept. And then eventually, when Ned is about to be beheaded, in the book, the High Septon is basically giving a little sermon before the, you know, Ned's supposed confession.
Mm.
Well, in the show, they give that to Pycelle, who's a maester. So
I
do think that, for the most part, the show has tried to remove a lot of faith elements, although they do, I guess they do bring that back in with the High Sparrow.
Yeah, I suppose I wondered if they deliberately kind of fudge the difference between the septons and the maesters. In the show, I think the maesters are possessed of a kind of quasi-religious authority. Even, you know, they're there as a spiritual and moral support, which, you know, you could see as a kind of religious type thing.
Yeah, and we were talking about monastic orders. I mean, the Citadel functions a little bit like that as well. I mean, not in the same way, but
the Citadel as well, and indeed the Maesters, that the educational element, but particularly, you know, the writing and the keeping of history, has a very obvious monastic link as well, because, you know, medieval monastic houses were the record keepers, that they wrote down the histories of the day. They were entrusted to do that. That carried on in these institutions over time.
So if you truly want to be a historian, Ian,
I need to be a Maester.
you need to forsake your last name and your family, and you're really going about this in a very half-assed kind of way.
I think I would always admit to that. Yeah.
We're getting geared up for the 6th annual Summer Badass Fest. And while we're working on a slate of apex badass films to enjoy, we've got an early action-packed announcement to make.
Just like last year, we're kicking off Badass Season with a live movie watch and podcast recording. We've rented out a theater for connoisseurs of action films and Bald Move fans that just want to have a great time.
Unlike last year, this year's movie is top secret. Hush, hush. No hints, except it's incredibly badass. It stars an absolute icon of the genre. We're willing to bet most of you haven't seen it, and it's going to be an incredible viewing experience with a packed house of Bald Movers.
Those of you who came to last year's screening of Total Recall know what a party it was. And those of you who didn't, now's your chance to experience it. Meet me and Jim, order some custom movie-themed drinks at the theater's full bar, then watch us record the full podcast for the movie. We reserved a venue over twice the size as last year, but seating is still limited.
It's happening Friday, June 21st at 7 p.m. in our hometown of Cincinnati. Get full details and buy tickets at baldmove.com/live.
Cincinnati's actually a pretty great city to visit, and we've got lots of details for side adventures on our event page as well. The Reds are playing the Boston Red Sox in their fantastic Riverside Stadium. The thrills of Kings Island just minutes away, and I'll be leading a kayak trip down the scenic Little Miami River on Saturday.
Again, get full details and get your tickets now on our Badass Fest 6 page at baldmove.com/live. Here are the highlights coming up this week on Bald Move.
We've got lots of ongoing coverage this week, from book versus show comparisons for Hot D to the latest very special episode of Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? But there are a couple of main events this week you need to know about.
Firstly, we've got a brand new commission podcast out this Tuesday covering the Raid 2, sometimes subtitled Retaliation. If you're a fan of martial arts films, this is one you don't want to miss. Iko Uwe is a rising star in the action movie world, and it's easy to see why. Join us on Tuesday as we dive into the bigger, badder sequel to The Raid, try and figure out which is better.
Then on Thursday, we're covering the season finale of Hulu's excellent period drama, Shogun. We've been waiting all season to see what Toranaga-sama's plan is, or if he even has one. It all comes down to this, and we couldn't be more excited. Join us on Thursday for what's sure to be an epic Shogun season finale podcast, and to find out if we plan to cover any related materials.
You find these and many other great podcasts by searching for Bald Move Pulp or Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app.
And now, Steve and I talk about the unfortunately named episode Dance of Dragons. Double D's, why do we have to confuse everybody? This is the episode where Arya recognizes Mirin Trant, Shireen gets burned at the stake, Jon brings the wildlings south, and Drogon enters the fighting pits. Here is comic Steve Osborne. Steve, how do you feel about human sacrifice?
You know, I don't have the data in front of me in terms of effectiveness ratios.
Sure, sure.
I bet you I could probably get a pretty decent ballpark of the official human sacrifices. But what I don't know that I have is, but here's what happened. Now that the sacrifice was made, all things were better, right? I mean, like, that part I don't have. So I'm not going to rush to judgment until I see that data.
Well, could we use, like, Temple of Doom as a test case?
Well, sure. So every time Molaram,
yeah, sure,
would remove a heart, mm-hmm. They'd send the afflicted down into the lava pit, and then the heart would burn. So we knew that there was a relationship.
Right. At least from the perspective of Indiana Jones, when the afflicted, well, let's call not the afflicted, let's say the gift, the human gift, mm-hmm. was sent into the lava, the heart which had been removed would then burn in the priest's hand.
Sure. And if that's the goal?
Well, I think the goal
is effective.
Okay, so, all right.
If it's, look, I'm going to show you, if I pull this heart out here, burn the body, the heart will burn. If it's just like a routine, a bit.
I think that the outcome you're looking for is to freak people out. Sure. I don't even know if you need the human sacrifice unless you want to freak people out.
It seemed like there was an obedience factor in there, right? Oh.
Tell me more.
Well, it seemed like it's a display of ritualistic power. And what I don't have a full understanding of, like, could any one of these people be a gift at any given moment? Is there a punishment that goes along with, like, hey, you did this wrong, we're going to sacrifice you? So the display of fire assumes that there is, Molaram has this sort of supernatural power that allows that to happen. That if you just ripped out somebody's heart, threw them into a pit, the heart would just sort of get gross. Whereas in this case, it still beats. So, like, that's showing that he has some sort of supernatural power. So now he is asserted into a certain amount of authority.
Right.
So
yeah, he's the conduit of the power, or he is the power, or something mm-hmm. like that.
Yeah, yeah. So then you're like, okay, well, I'm already inferior to him in this regard. So I'm going to defer a certain amount of power of authority. And if there's a possibility that he also gets to decide who gets to go in this thing, it's in my best interest to kind of keep my nose clean.
We've mentioned the much maligned season 5, right?
Yeah.
And this relates to Dorne, right? Or at least yes. The Dorne plot. Well, this is the other, I think this is the other side of the coin. People were really upset about Shireen. Okay. And the death of Shireen, and they didn't like it, and it hadn't...
Yeah, the death... I mean, this season has the death of Shireen, the rape of Sansa, all of Dorne. I mean, there are, like, some three heavy-hitting, moments, right?
Yeah, so after the Sansa thing, people were, like, really upset, and they were already a little bit jaded because of the Dorne stuff. And then when this thing happens to Shireen, it's like... Yeah, you know, a lot of people were just like, I'm done. I don't want to see this. I don't want any of this.
Really? Like, so I was moved by the Shireen sacrifice, but not like, I guess for me, I'm like, all right, yeah, it seems like something. Like, I mean, it's awful, but that's the point, right?
Well, sure. Yeah, it's the point, but you have to understand.
It's not like they were like, it's not like the showrunners are like, I thought for sure people would be like excited about this.
Yeah, but I think people had come to like her.
Well, yeah, that's, I think that's,
and
that helps.
And it's one of those things where it's like, I mean, there are certain things that don't work thematically or the dialogue, like all of the Dorne stuff. It's like just critically, it's not likable, right? And right. Then there are times when the show will just hurt your feelings. Mm. You know, anytime a wolf dies, that's bad. Rob dying, that was bad. Ned dying. These are all things that really hurt your feelings. And it's at some point, you just think, you know what? I don't want my feelings to be hurt anymore. And I think a lot of people were like, yeah, I can put up with a lot, but that just hurts my feelings.
Okay.
There are things about the season that are just sort of critically problematic. And then there are things about the season that will just sort of generally hurt fans' feelings. So if you get the critics upset and the fans upset, it generally isn't a good chemistry.
This didn't bother me.
Well, clearly, I mean, you have a high tolerance for human sacrifice. We've already established that, right?
I was effectively bothered by the fact that this was happening, mm-hmm. but as a plot mover, I mean, here's the thing, right? Shireen's not taking the Iron Throne, so I'm becoming like a little bit more of a man of economy when it mm-hmm. comes to characters at this point.
Hey, if Tommen can be on the Iron Throne, certainly Shireen can be on the Iron Throne.
Here's the thing, right? Everything is moving this direction, it seems like. Melisandre's there's a lot about her that I'm still not sure what I know. Like, is she a zealot because she's deeply impacted, or is she a zealot for her own gain? You know, there's all these different elements there that I think are very intriguing, right? And the degree of influence that she has over Stannis has been since the introduction of him a major source of tension. Mm-hmm. It creates tension between his own fidelity to his wife. It takes its tension to his relationship to his homie, Davos, who's more than just his hand. He's his homie. And they've been homies for years. And so there's that element. And then now they've done a good job of giving you the opportunity. Like, Stannis was, I think, warming on people. Right. Mm-hmm. Or people were warming to Stannis because of the relationship with Shireen. Right. So the whole time I'm like, why is she there? Why is she there? So there was a preparation for things are not going to go well for Shireen. Like, that part, I think I'd already resolved to.
Well, there was a hint, right? There was a hint that there was someone with his blood that would be an effective sacrifice. Sure. And then this episode really kind of.
Well, because the last time we saw them, she basically says this was going to happen, and he just like, no. And then as soon as the episode starts off with like, oh, something bad is happening to his team, I'm like, oh, here we go. And you don't want it, but it's – so here we go, right? So now Stannis falls in the same ranks, you know, especially for Heather at this point, as Jaime and Theon.
Sure.
They're donezo. Because if Jaime is irredeemable for pushing Bran through a window and – Theon is irredeemable mm-hmm. for burning a couple of orphans, then hey, you put your daughter on the stake, and I don't care how good your voice
is. Yeah, no, I think that kind of goes to my point about feelings being hurt, right? Because so not only do we see Shireen out of the picture, now Stannis in a way is dead to the narrative in a way that he wasn't before, right? He's like
he's all in. There's no more tension.
Yeah. Okay. So yeah, Stannis is just like, okay, you're about as interesting to me as one of the other garden variety villains that we've met in this show.
Sure.
This episode starts with a burning horse galloping by.
Right. And nobody seems to care about that. We're okay with that.
I think I was thinking about this. I was thinking it's pretty typical for a story, especially fantasy literature, to give you some sort of animal guide at the beginning. Like, some character will, like, follow an animal into a wood, and something magical will happen there. So the animals are used to sort of introduce this magical world. And I kind of felt like with this episode, the fact that it begins with a horse on fire running through a camp, it's sort of like, hey, guess what? This is going to be bananas. Like, this episode is going to be bananas.
Well, it's like you can almost now, instead of like when you say something's bananas or bonkers, now you can just say, man, it's like a horse on fire out there.
It's like a horse on fire. That's right. This entire episode is a horse on fire. So, all right. So, clearly, Heather has a problem with Stannis now. But because you're kind of pro-human sacrifice...
Yeah, and she knows that, and she knows she was marrying. So she's like, "Oh boy, Steve's gonna be all over the."
So you didn't mind so much. You're like, she served her purpose.
Well, this one I think is interesting, right? I mean, I kind of understand like the well, wait a minute, I invested in Rob, and now you killed Rob and Lady Stark, all this stuff. So like, now what do you do, right? But at the same time, I'm like, but that's we signed up for this, man. We signed up for a lot of stuff right out the gate. Right out the gate. I mean, it's not like Game of Thrones was a slow burn.
Right. Yeah, this started with two beheadings in the first episode.
Yeah.
Right?
We immediately, in a scene of incest, follows pushing a kid out of a window. And now people are like, I don't know. This seems like it's gone up a notch.
Yeah,
guys, what show have you been watching?
There's something about everyone's got a line. And violence for weird religious reasons is just going to be a line for a lot of people. And as it should be.
Does that hit home? Is that a subject that maybe needs to be explored? Is that?
I mean, look, the founding of the United States was all about hunting witches out. Because we're worried about nature and the dark magic that's in nature and go burn them at the stake. There's just something really gross about the whole thing. So maybe it does. Maybe it's sort of this built into us as this horrible part of our own past.
I guess. But also, I think there's a fascinating notion that it's like the witch doing the burning. I mean, it's a wonderful flip-flop, right? I mean, I think that there's, again, Yeah, the Shireen thing is problematic because I think that's the point.
Melisandre knocked on your door and said, "Hi, I'm Melisandre. I like to burn dudes." And that's kind of the first thing you need to know about me. I like to burn dudes.
Yeah.
And, you know, there are other things about me that you may be interested in knowing. But the first thing you got to know is that I burn dudes.
Right. And to be clear, everybody that's burned that we've seen her burn... They have a backstory, too, and they were somebody's child at one point. So just everyone settle down, all right? You know, you can't just gloss over like, oh, there's like 17 people being burned. Yeah, but I don't know them. I don't know if that guy that's screaming in agony could read. So, yeah. I mean, if you want your hot take for this particular podcast, yep, totally pro cooking Shireen.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, I'm glad. I'm glad we have you on the record.
Well, and the thing is, it was a moving scene. Her screams are, you know, talk about, yeah, I mean, I guess maybe this also follows in the same category of like, do we need the sound? It's like, yeah. Got the sound instead of the imagery in this one. I think, I mean, and then watching the mother switch, that was, to me, that was such a powerful scene. Because her maternal instincts kick in such a way that, like, it really helped with the Stannis. Like, you're supposed to hate Stannis now. You could, if you're going to try to advocate a little for Stannis,
mm-hmm.
you know, they've run out of provisions. His army is in worse shape. It's getting snowy. He can't really go back. Can't really go forward. They may already be dead. Like, right. There is that element, right? That he's like, look, my daughter's going to die here anyway. But, look, if I do nothing, we all die. If I burn my daughter, worst case scenario, she just dies sooner. Best case scenario, you know, magic. Right? Right? I mean, I'm not saying
no,
I'm not.
No, you're not right. You're wrong. I think.
What if I said it like this? We're all going to die anyway. She just dies warmer.
All right. I mean, if you say it like that.
If she, look, we're all going to freeze to death. She goes out in a blaze of comfort.
In a blaze of comfort. That was one of my favorite Bon Jovi lines.
It was actually a PSA for electric blankets that were shorting out.
And they had Bon Jovi do the jingle for it, but instead of a blaze of glory,
it was a blaze of comfort.
Yeah, okay.
There are certain things that I say that make myself giggle. Blaze of comfort might be one of them.
The other horse on fire thing about this episode was that Arya goes full Tarantino. She sees Mirren Trant. Oh man, you know what? I think I just gave you a little spoiler for the next
episode. Oh, I don't know. I thought we were just talking because I was looking at it as an observation from like the GIMP situation.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Watching. No, I see. Yeah, that works. That works.
She's very voyeuristic.
So we learned that. Yeah, okay. So sorry about that. We learned that Mirren Trant, who you will recall, killed Serial Pharrell, the beloved Serial.
Right. Pharrell. Okay. I will say that's what I forgot. I forgot who he killed on her, you know, to get on the list exactly.
I think that what we're supposed to understand, and maybe the show has not done a great job at explaining this, but that Arya's got this list. But she kind of lacks the ability to be a full-on assassin.
Right.
Because she's a kid.
Part of it is access.
Right. She's learned a lot about killing, but she kind of wants to go pro. Right. You know, she's the Stiglitz of Game of Thrones.
Yes.
And then she sees someone who's on her list. And I think what this episode is trying to do is it's trying to show you she's got a decision to make. Does she become no one, right? Or does she keep her vendetta? Because her vendetta is tied up in her own identity, right?
Well, exactly right. And the way you say it is explicit and helpful. But that's where I was feeling the tension, right? Is like as soon as she diverted from her path, of her assignment, so to speak, it was absolutely a return to her identity.
Right, and so she's got to decide, am I Arya Stark who has a kill list, or am I no one who doesn't care about things like my last name and, you know, who I was before this? And so she kind of has to decide, well, am I going to become this super assassin, or am I going to go just kill this guy who's on my list? And right. I think that we're supposed to understand that, okay, and then we follow the guy to the brothel, and we learn that he's
awful.
He's just, he's a garbage person.
Yeah.
And so now we, you know, as audience members, I think we're thinking, yeah, if anyone deserves to die, it's this guy, right?
Sure. Sure.
So, I don't know. Maybe they didn't do a great job of explaining that. I think a lot of Arya's story this season has been maybe too understated or too subtle.
I mean, like, I got it, but I don't know that I got it. I was taken by the distraction, right? I'm like, okay, she's clearly now deviating from her course. Mm-hmm. Then it brings up, like, so then what do you want, right? And what is it? And I don't, but I think that that's the lesson. I don't think she knows what, mm-hmm. she's still a kid. And it's an interesting way to demonstrate that someone is still kind of youthful but still having them be murderous.
Yeah, that's right.
It's fascinating, right? But that's Westeros, baby.
So this is a really religion-heavy season because we got all the politics at King's Landing with this High Sparrow guy, right? And then we actually see sort of this fire god magic. And then you've got this weird thing with Arya happening where, in the way that a lot of religions try to eschew ego, like you cast off ego in order to find enlightenment, I think that there's something happening with Arya where she's thinking, if I want purpose in my life, I'm going to have to delete, like right-click and delete on a lot of who I am in order to sort of throw myself into this religious identity.
Right.
I think that Arya can't quite give up her identity. And I think in all of these ways, well, you just see drastically different outcomes for all of these scenarios. it feels like, oh, you're not just telling me the same thing over and over again about religion. And I think that's what a lot of shows will do. Like, it's like even with, you know, shows that really play with religion, like The New Pope, I feel like, yeah, but aren't you just trying to tell me over and over this, giving me the same cautionary story about being too religious or being a hypocrite or whatever? I feel like there's like this slow, steady drumbeat in a lot of prestige television that critiques religion. But I feel like Martin is critiquing like four different religions from four different angles. And I find it fascinating in a way that I don't see in other shows.
So do you feel better about this season on the rewatch because of that? Or did you still appreciate all that stuff, but like, yeah, Dorne sucks?
I appreciate it more on the rewatch. On review, I found Dorne more interesting than I did before, and I find the stuff in Meereen less interesting than I did before.
Interesting. Yeah, Meereen hasn't done a ton for me. I like plenty, but it's not like I find myself impatient with Meereen. And I think this episode helps quite a bit with that impatience.
Well, I mean, talk about a horse on fire.
Yeah, baby.
Drogon deciding to put his hat in the ring, you know, taking on all challengers. That was next level stuff.
And here I am, you know, reticent about dragons in the beginning, but man, I was rooting for that dragon. I was like, because I'm sitting there and I'm watching that thing go on. I looked over at Heather and I'm like, it's Drogon time. And then we hear the screech and I'm like, oh,
now, did
oh,
you
hell
think
yeah.
that before she closed her eyes or after she closed her eyes?
Before.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Because I'm like, there's no way out. Dude, Drogon's got to come in here. And then she closed her eyes and I'm like, oh, hell yeah. Like, so that was, it was a sequential thing.
Yeah. I mean, once you hear the shriek of the dragon.
Yeah. Yeah.
And
I was in.
Yeah.
I know we discussed this a little bit, but I told Heather this last night too. I'm like, I could watch an entire episode of Tyrion reacting to dragons.
Yeah. That's really great. You know, the backstory with Tyrion is that as a kid, he was always fascinated with dragons. And in one scene in the book, when he's heading up to the wall, like early on, he's reading a book about dragons. And so there's like these little seeds planted that he loves dragon lore. Like that's his jam. He likes to read all about dragons, and that's kind of what he does for fun. So I think knowing that about him makes me think, oh, he's like wetting his pants. He's so happy about this dragon.
Right. There's a mixture of joy and like, and full on like horrific appreciation.
Yeah. Right.
Like, I know what these things can do. I love that we're starting to really feel the sense of like the fire and ice dilemma. Right. I mean, we start with fire. We end with fire, fire all throughout. Like, this is a very fire centric episode.
Dismemberment count. We lost a head of unknown fighter who was quick, but only until he lost his head.
Yeah.
Now, I feel like you think that these guys are badasses who are fighting in the ring, and then Drogon shows up, and it's like, oh, this is a whole different sport.
Right. Well, and that changes that, and that's I think Tyrion's look at the end, which is that's how I took it too. Is not only, oh my god, it's a dragon, how cool! It's like, I'm on the team with the dragon. It's official. Yeah. This was a good year of free agency for me.
Yeah. Once you draft the dragon, it's kind of
yeah. Because you're looking at it, you're like, okay, I don't know what alliances are happening now in King's Landing. I mean, sounds like things are a little rough everywhere. But, you know, I got the dragon. I got an army that's getting less because of the Sons of the Harpy. Mm. But of course, then there's the element of like, yeah, but she just took off with the dragon. You're still in the pit.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Now, that was sort of, okay, two things about the dragon. One is, I like that the dragon isn't all powerful. Like, some of those spears go in.
Yeah, and he's clearly wounded.
This guy can't take, I mean, he can't just take unlimited spears. Like, there is some danger here.
Right.
And then, of course, her flying away on the dragon. Because it always seemed a little, I guess the hints have been, Danny can't control these things.
Right.
And are you going to really trust that you are going to be able to control this dragon 200 feet in the air?
Well, and the thing, too, is like there's this, one of the reasons why she got as far as she has is because at least she either had dragons or there was the mystique of dragons. But then, you know, in this season, the dragons have gotten locked up. She's been having to lead. She's kind of leading on reputation. Sure, she's freed people, but that's not necessarily turning into the bankable asset that it was earlier because it's caused all these problems in Marine. And so it's kind of like, well, you know, sure, she's got Tyrion, but like, is it gone too, like, is it too little too late? Because there's that's kind of where it feels like it's building up to in when they are all in the pit.
Yeah.
Very poetic that she's now caught in the pit that she reluctantly signed on for. And she's surrounded. And it's like, well, your mystique is gone. The two dragons that you sort of have control over are locked away. They can't help you now. Your army is getting cut up pretty bad. Nobody cares about you. Like in here, nobody cares about you. And then we get the reminder. So that was really, but it also shows that, like, you know, take the dragons away from Danny and, you know, what do you got?
All right. Something that didn't work for you this episode.
It's just being in Dorne for the most part. I really don't like, what's her name? The mother in Dorne.
Ellaria Sand. Yeah. I mean, in general, I mean, I actually liked her when she was palling around with Oberyn.
Yeah, I would agree. And then also,
she's not a great mother. I mean, I don't like to judge other people's parenting techniques, but I don't think she's very good at this whole mothering.
Because everything just seemed like any subtlety that the show is doing, it completely abandons in Dorne, even when it comes to like dialogue. Mm-hmm. And even Jamie, like, I'm not really compelled by him in Dorne. Like, he just seems off. Everything seems off. So
just so you know,
and yeah,
these are, I couldn't help myself. I looked up the names of the Sand Snake daughters: Nymeria or Nym, Tyene, and Obra Sand.
Okay.
And this will be the last time we speak of them.
All right. It's a good deal.
Good deal. All right.
But again, to be clear, I actually like the complication. I liked rescuing of the daughter niece. Mm-hmm. There's a lot about that I actually think is intriguing.
Yeah. And all right, something that worked for you.
Well, I mean, outside of the, you know, like finally getting the death of Shireen. I am very, very keen on what happens when Davos finds out about what happened. If he even makes it, I don't know. We'll find out. But like, that could be a pretty rich storyline.
Does it mean that Davos is going to argue with Stannis about something?
Look, Your Grace, you know I follow you anywhere. I'll give up my fingers for you, but I just feel like you shouldn't have cooked your own daughter. No more questions further than I come out.
Like, I want him to get, like, more and more, like, unintelligible as it goes along.
I was always told my bad face about it.
We're about 10 weeks out from House of the Dragon Season 2, and it's time to prepare for war.
Which in our case means, well, watching a lot of Hot D and reading a lot of Fire and Blood.
Each week between now and June 16th, Maester Anthony and his co-host Steve are hosting a watch of each episode of Hot D Season 1. And then me and Jim are going to host a discussion of the differences between the events on that episode and how they're recounted in George R.R. Martin's historical tome, Fire and Blood.
That's right, I've resorted to reading dragon books. God help us all. We'll see if my fresh eyes add any new insights or predictions into Season 2.
Arm yourselves with all the lore you can for the battles ahead. House of the Dragon returns June 16th, but we've got you covered until then.
Check out all of our upcoming Hot D coverage on the Hot D feed or on Bald Move Pulp, available wherever you listen to podcasts. FX is adapting James Clavell's best-selling novel, Shogun, into a 10-part miniseries this spring. Set in the shogunate period of Japan at the turn of the 15th century, Shogun depicts the rise of a feudal lord to Shogun, as seen through the eyes of a shipwrecked English sailor. It's loosely based on the real-life exploits of William Adams and Tokugawa Ieyasu.
Shogun has already been successfully adapted back in 1980 with a widely acclaimed miniseries starring Richard Chamberlain, featuring intricate plots, political scheming, complex characters, and thrilling action. This time, husband and wife team Justin Marks and Rachel Kondo try to recapture the successes of the novel and early adaptations while increasing the levels of historical and cultural accuracy that are often perceived as flaws of this and similar works.
Starring Hiroyuki Sanada from The Last Samurai, Mortal Kombat, and John Wick 4, with Cosmo Jarvis of Peaky Blinders, Raised by Wolves, etc., joining the truly massive cast required to bring this complex world to life. Join Aaron and I each week as we deep dive into each episode, uncovering the mysteries, the intrigue, and the glory of Shogun.
Shogun premieres on FX Hulu Tuesday, February 27th, with a two-part debut. Our podcast will release each Thursday thereafter. Get our Shogun coverage by searching for Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app. Hey, it's time for another season of Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? The premise is simple. A Gen Xer and a millennial watch old 80s action TV to see what still works and what doesn't. In previous seasons, we've done podcasts for Knight Rider, Airwolf, MacGyver, A-Team, and more. However, this year we're doing a very special season of Feeny. We're going back and reviewing the very special episodes of 80s and 90s sitcoms. Come cringe along with us as Hollywood tries to warn our families of the dangers of underage smoking, drug abuse, alcoholism, eating disorders, and much more. We start out with the episode of Boy Meets World where a high school kid gets sucked into a cult. Worlds collide as the Mr. Feeny finally makes an appearance on Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? Join me and my buddy Jay each week for episodes full of nostalgia and secondhand embarrassment. And don't worry, if Very Special isn't your speed, we've also got some all-time classic Knight Rider episodes to close the season with. Find Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? Each Wednesday on Bald Move Pulp, starting April 3rd.
For this week's Bird's Eye View, I want to include a short excerpt of my longer conversation with Chris Swank. Chris is on faculty at Signum University. She is an expert in Tolkien studies, which of course is one of my favorite topics to talk about. But here we talk about an essay she wrote on the celibate societies of Westeros. And that can be found in a book titled Game of Thrones versus History. Here's a clip of my conversation with Chris Swank. So, Chris, you've written an essay on the celibate societies of Westeros in a book called Game of Thrones versus History. Do I have that right? What's the essay title?
The essay is called I Shall Take No Wife.
Okay. All right. And I'm assuming that you're looking at the Night's Watch, among other institutions?
Exactly. The Poor Brothers and the Silent Sisters, and there's a lot of not having sex going on in Westeros.
Well, that's interesting because there's a lot of having sex going on too.
Right? It really gets a reputation for being a very sexualized series, but when you look at it, there's all of these societies that their members have to vow to be celibate, which is really quite interesting. But
well, it is interesting because of the importance of progeny for everyone, at least everyone. Most of the people we meet in this book are sort of high society types. So there's going to be some sort of transfer of wealth. And of course, progeny is paramount. So who gets to have the sex and who doesn't get to have the sex is interesting.
Right. If your lady is at home in the keep while you're out making war on somebody, you don't want her to be making babies with the maester or... Right?
No, you don't.
Yeah. So you've got to trust those people that you leave back home when you're gone.
Well, let me ask you this about the Night's Watch, if you don't mind.
Yeah, no problem.
So I've been trying to foist this theory on folks that the Night's Watch looks a lot like some of these militaristic orders, but has a lot in common with monastic orders. And yet, you know, some of the pushback I've got is, yeah, but they're mostly secular. And I wonder if, what would your take be on that?
Well, some of those orders, like the Templars and the Hospitallers, were both monastic and militaristic orders.
Yeah. You're singing my tune. Keep going.
Absolutely. Also, the Roman legions were to be unmarried for the 25 years.
That's that they, not a great idea, join, by the way, but keep going.
Yeah, they would join up for 25 years.
Uh-huh.
Of course, they were having sex with the local women wherever they were posted. Of course they were. But, I mean, we have the evidence in the forts of, like, little baby shoes and women's shoes in the archaeological remains of forts in Britain.
Interesting.
But officially, they were unmarried for the time that they served the Roman Legion. And then once they got done with their very mere 25 years of service,
right,
they could then get married and have families.
All right. So then at about the time of Hadrian's Wall, what would we expect of the Roman garrison up there?
Yes. That's what we would expect of the Roman garrison up there.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. I love it.
So. It was a policy for a really long time. I think Septimus Severus got rid of it sometime around 200. So it could cross over to that Hadrian's Wall fort time. But
yeah, okay.
But we know from the forts up at the remains of the forts at Hadrian's Wall that there were baby shoes and women's items in the remains of those forts. We also know that a bunch of them stayed on in Britain after they were released from service and stayed with the families that they had made unofficially.
Interesting. I absolutely appreciate that. My thanks to Chris, and I can't wait to have her back to talk more about Catelyn Stark. Just a reminder, look for Perfect Stranger Things and our other podcast on the movies that inspired Stranger Things, which is called Cocoons of Horror. And that is all for this week.